Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Molly Malloy and the Angel of Death by Maria Vale, narrated by Raven Wildwood. Part 1. The Book of Admonishments. Chapter 1. Neil Steinhauer occasionally thought about Janine. She'd been very sweet and liked him, possibly loved him. Well, probably not loved, but she would have married him if he'd asked. He hadn't asked because he thought he could get someone prettier, someone who showed better at office parties and reunions. It hadn't happened that way. And now, in his 60s, Steinhauer was 10 years past giving up. The skin of his hands had thickened and dried, and he had one borrowed kidney and 9 toes. Everyone who saw him at the donut hole in Harrow watched disapprovingly when he bought 3 jelly-filled. Then he shuffled painfully past the censorious line waiting for chilatas and died. At which point, Neil Steinhauer's part in the salvation of the world was done and taken up by a raspberry jelly-filled that Death took from Mr. Steinhauer's bag because he was always hungry. And because he knew any food in the immediate vicinity of the First World Dead would be discarded. Death's next appointments were in places that are typically called war-torn, as though war had only ripped them once, rather than shredding them time and time again, like a weed whacker through bluegrass. So, when Death entered the room in Mount Sinai, he pulled on the elbow-length rubber gloves he got by the gross from a restaurant supply shop on the Bowery, and checked the first mirror he'd seen since eating Mr. Steinhauer's donut. There was powdered sugar on the lapel of his greatcoat. He shoved his list into one big outer pocket and flicked at the pail dusting. Between the pocketing and the flicking, he rather lost track. In the room, an ancient woman lay in her bed, her eyes closed, her mouth open. Although she was covered by a gown and sheet, Death knew that underneath, her body had shriveled and bruised around the places where tubes had been pushed in to extract some fluids and to insert others. He missed the days when the whole family gathered at home, and the old people would give away the teapot to this one and the cow to that one, and when he touched them, the old men and older women would smile at him, because they knew that he wasn't a problem to be solved by intubation. At least this one wasn't alone. There was a young woman next to her wolfing something down. Her head was bent low over the box, her lips smeared bright orange. Chicken wings, by the looks of it. Slow down, Death thought, patting her absently on the back. She coughed once, then wiped her mouth on a stained napkin. After looking at him for a disconcertingly long moment, during which Death dusted his lapel again, she said, "You're here for my grandmother?" Death craned his neck around to see who she was talking to. "You? I'm talking to you."
"Me?"
he said, alarm making his voice sound squeaky. "You've come for my grandmother, right?" Death looked toward the shriveled pile of blankets and nodded dumbly. "Just a minute, I really gotta wash my hands," she said, wiggling her fingers in the air between them.
"What?"
"The doctor said you could be coming at any time, but they've been saying that for years, so I wasn't quite sure I believed him. Can you give me a minute?"
"Yes?"
Death squeaked again, then cleared his throat. The girl headed to the sink and washed her face and hands in the pink antibacterial soap. She wiped her mouth on her sleeve. "Mind passing me a couple of paper towels?" "Thanks," she said after he had. Then she held out the styrofoam container filled with bright orange wings. "Want some? They're good, but I'm kind of done." Death had been called the devourer of worlds, but that didn't mean he was above a meaty chicken wing, so he took one. "Sorry," the girl said, pouring iced water from the mustard yellow pitcher into a plastic glass, while Death flapped his hands in front of him, desperately gulping air that was doing nothing to cool his seared tongue. "I suppose I should have told you they were atomic." While he flapped and gulped, the girl leaned over her unconscious grandmother, as though meaning to say something, but an awkward moment later seemed to think better of it. "I guess we're ready," she said, holding her grandmother's limp hand and looking at him expectantly. Using the gloved hand that wasn't stained orange by atomic sauce, Death pushed his fingers to the old woman's sunken abdomen, just at her omphalos, the spot that whatever other tragedy hit the womb was always there. It was the place that tied the baby to its mother, and threw her to the whole long, disastrous chain of humanity. It was the doorway of the soul, the entrance and the exit, the beginning and the end. Most of the time, the souls in failing bodies came easily, recognizing an escape from pain, from fear, from despair, or simply from having been around too long. This one did not. He had to push in deeper, digging around until he found the stubborn old woman. He pulled hard, but she held on even harder. He buttressed one thick-soled black boot against the side rail and pulled with both hands. Death felt more than a little embarrassed at making a muddle of things in front of his first audience ever in the history of this whole sordid adventure. To speed things up, he took out the sharp shard of obsidian he kept in his outer pocket and drew a line across the old woman's forehead. It didn't pierce the skin, but her soul zipped up like a roller blind in an old cartoon. Then, with one more mighty tug, a length of velvety black emerged from the weakened body, accompanied by a final breath. "Do you always have trouble like that?" the young woman asked.
No, not usually, he said.
He held the old woman's rag high and swirled it expertly into his curved palm, opening the oversized gray greatcoat that he'd been wearing ever since his well-worn cassock had gotten caught on a bayonet at Possandala. He slipped Grandma's soul into a red flannel pocket, one of the multitude of tiny patches he'd sewn and re-sewn over the years.
So, she said, we done here? I guess, he said.
Alrighty then. Then, the young woman started to squeeze past him toward the door. He touched the warmth of her and took in the faint, mossy scent beneath the smell of antibacterial soap and betadine in habanero. It made him feel uncomfortable and like he ought to say something to pretend he wasn't.
Until next time, he offered.
She paused for a moment, one eyebrow slightly raised. You know what? Don't rush.
Yuh-oh,
he thought.
This is going to be trouble.
Chapter 2. As soon as he got home, Death cleared out his overstuffed mailbox and headed upstairs to his apartment. Once there, he dropped the mail on his kitchen table and emptied his big outer pockets into the upside-down lime-green cake taker that sat on top of the chest he'd been schlepping around since the second Babylonian captivity. Gently laying his coat across the futon, he retrieved the orange plastic laundry basket from the defunct fireplace. He'd fitted the basket with a liner sewed from a flannel blanket, so that even if it was full, none of the soles would slip through the cutouts that served as handles. He carefully unloaded each of the little inner pockets of his coat, pausing for a moment with the struggling rag he had collected with such difficulty at Mount Sinai, before dropping it among all the other writhing splotches of charcoal and black. As soon as he was done, the basket disappeared with a hushed whoosh. Death retrieved a new box of peanut butter crunch from a shelf filled with them, and pulling either side of the waxy bag, opened it with no tears, an act that always gave him inordinate satisfaction. Hunched over his large bowl, he looked through the pile of letters and free magazines. He set aside an intimate mail catalog addressed to Resident for later, and started reading the cards addressed to Dear Friend or Valued Neighbor. Their congenial concern for his well-being always made him feel appreciated, which was no small thing in his line of work. He didn't bother to look when his laundry basket, empty now, fell back to the floor with a loud thunk. Death had been doing this job for 197,856 years, ever since that woman in the cave that held her babies close and thought, I am going to die. Not in the specific, I am being eaten by this larger, hungrier creature, or I am sinking into this smelly, inescapable bog, but in the more existential, I am alive now, and I will not always be, and I am afraid. At that moment, the stinking, lice-ridden, combative, sex-mad, perpetually decaying, fearful animals became human, and it had been decided. They needed a psychopomp, someone to guide them through the transition from the existence they were now aware they had. That someone would have to live among the stinking, lice-ridden, combative, sex-mad, perpetually decaying, fearful humans. There was a lot of nervous shuffling among the custodes rectorum, the keepers of righteousness. Quick sidelong glances were followed by the holding of hands, smelling faintly of frankincense, to delicate upturned noses. Then someone, Death always suspected it was that jerk Salafiel, called out, "How about Azriel?" A murmur swept through the custodes. They all agreed it made sense. Azriel had failed righteousness 4 times, was always the last chosen for any game of obedience, a complete botch-up at venerating,
"Are you sure you know what you're doing, Sanctus, Sanctus?"
and saying all the time, even though he couldn't carry a tune. More to the point, it would keep him busy, keep him out of trouble, because, well, they all remembered what happened last time. Plus, nobody else wanted the job. Azriel had some reservations, but then he'd looked at the prissy Hosanna singers to the right of him and the prissy Hosanna singers to the left, at which point he said,
"Oh, what the hey?"
A sigh of relief blew across the heavens like a jasmine-scented wind on an evening in Sorrento. "We'll visit," they'd promised, patting him wanly on the back.
"Don't bother,"
he'd responded, and leaned backward, letting himself fall through the ether. When he landed, he was no longer Azriel. He was Death, the Grey Walker, the Pale Rider, the Dark Companion, and many other descriptive turns of phrase, though, in fact, the only time any human had seen him was at the exact millisecond they snuffed it, which went some way toward explaining the diversity of opinion as to his appearance. Death wiped out his bowl and set it on the grooved enamel drainboard. One thing was sure. That girl had seen him. Not only seen him, but recognized him, talked to him, bossed him around, offered him a chicken wing, then poured him a glass of water, watched him struggle. Then she'd made it clear that she didn't want to see him any more than he wanted to see her. To distract himself, Death sat on his futon with the intimate mail catalog in one hand and his obsidian blade in the other. He'd started out like every other custodes, with eyes to gaze, lips to praise, hands to raise, and a nose to smell out corruption. But then he'd started making changes. At first, he'd lengthened his nose and enlarged his eyes, explaining to anyone who asked that it was necessary because the stench was strong and the light was weak. Other changes he hid. He didn't want to have to explain, as he knew he would, that his body looked so bland, so empty by comparison to the variety of muscle, fat, color, hair, scars, moles, bone, and all the other Baroque embellishments of mortality. Here, for example, he looked at the picture on the cover of the Intimate Male Big Blowout Sale catalog. This man walked through the surf wearing nothing but white beach pants that were on sale for $35. There was so much complexity. The graceful broad ridge at the top of his chest, 2 big bulgy bits with teeny tiny dark bulgy bits on top, like muffin tops, with a chocolate chip plunked down in the middle of each. A series of lumps divided down the middle that looked like a big cicada shell. Dark hair scattered all over. He'd been working on ribs for the better part of a century. So far, they were just a few shallow runnels, palpable but not visible. He pulled up his t-shirt and felt for them. Then he cut through the celestial material of his body with his obsidian blade. Even as he watched, the furrow began to close. Just as he started to cut into the second runnel, he smelled frankincense, and a silvery swirl appeared at the foot of his futon.
"Rag picker,"
intoned a voice. Death quickly pulled his duvet up to his chin.
Whoa, Jophiel, don't suppose this could wait until later?
Later,
Jophiel repeated, before sprouting one of the aphorisms the custodians used to try to make sense of any word having to do with time.
We are when nothing was?
Never mind.
Like all custodians, Jophiel was timeless, existing then and now, and at all points in between. It made Death queasy, keeping track of all those simultaneous existences melding together into a shimmering worm of his iterations. Jophiel as he first arrived, and every Jophiel since, with the Jophiel of now at their head. And they all talked at the same time. The copy at the very end of the worm would continue to shout, "Rag picker!" in an endless loop until Jophiel went back up. He'd been the same when he'd first become Death. At the time, humans were still very sparse on the ground, so there was something comforting about the constant companionship of his past selves. Then, humans started settling and grouping together, and reproducing at an alarming rate. The settling and grouping was followed quickly by plagues and wars and other large slaughtering events, and Death had begun to find it confusing, always bumping into his earlier selves, still spelunking around in the empty omphaloi of the already dead. So he'd gone native, as Abdiel said with disgust, existing in one moment before moving on to another. Just him, like a human, except for the part about never dying. Death hadn't told Abdiel about the other thing, about how he'd learned to make any particular moment stretch out infinitely. There had been a time when humanity pirouetted on the edge of extinction. With only 2,000 souls, Abdiel worried that Death wasn't being kept busy and signed him up for a group, which was really just more righteousness, with the addition of choir. He hated group.
"Abdiel is sending memoranda,"
announced Jophiel, with the custodian's inability to conceive of any tense beyond the present.
"You are not having the matter attended to."
Then he indicated the discombobulated orange laundry basket and four intricately folded missives of Celadon papyrus splayed across the floor. Jophiel reached to the chain attached to the girdle around his robes. He pulled a pomander of chaste mother-of-pearl to his nose.
"Can we not be opening a window? The smell is absolutely sulfurous."
Then, with his free hand, Jophiel reached once more into his robe and, pulling out a scroll, shook it open before passing it to Death.
"Custodes rectorum indivisibilis eternalis e immutabilis."
"Rag picker. On June 15th, 2016, at 21, 27, 31, 116, mortal standards, you delivered the rag of one Mary Malloy, although the name on your list was clearly Molly Malloy. We expect to see you immediately after purification. Hallelujah, Abdiel. P.S. Read your mail. No one likes making these trips."
"We are telling Abdiel of your coming,"
asked Jophiel.
"When you are purifying?"
"Yes,"
Death said dully, his finger running once more over the scroll. The sibilant had not yet left Death's tongue when the Jophiel of now disappeared with a quick pop, followed by a series of diminishing pops, until after one final disapproving, "Rag picker," the original Jophiel vanished too. Pop. Death stared at the spot where Jophiel had been. With a sigh, he pulled himself up, tidied his bed, then went to his little bathroom and dropped a Dead Sea Salts and Sandalwood bath bomb into his tub before turning on the hot water spigot all the way. He made a few thousand pickups, allowing time and the water to run. When he returned, the tub was full. Stripping, he stepped into the scalding bath and scrubbed with a hard brush and myrrh soap. He dried himself with a fresh towel and pulled out the robes that he kept sealed in a dark green plastic suit bag. They were clean and loose and disguised most of what he'd done to his body. He pulled on a pair of white Vans he'd taken after a mall shooting in Georgia and kept boxed up in the back of the closet for just this eventuality. Then he jumped a few times until he grasped the bottom rung. It had been millennia since he'd last been up, so he wasn't surprised that the ladder was more than a little bulky. One more yank and it came down with a long squeal and a puff of dust. He started to climb.
"Ceased,"
commanded a concerned voice when he was still a full league away.
"It's just the rag picker,"
called Death.
"And yes, we have been purified."
He stopped to untangle his robe from the rubber bottoms of his Vans, then started again. From above, he could hear some muttering, as well as the still echoing,
"Ceased."
"Where is our pomander?"
Puriel yelled at some underling, because no matter how hard he scrubbed, the stench of the world clung to Death like gum to Doc Martens. A few rungs short of his destination, Death shook out his robes, holding them down so they would be sure to cover his legs when he drifted up.
"So, Puriel, been a while. How's Trix?"
"At stewarding, we are hearing of error."
Puriel leaned forward with a kind of morbid curiosity before jerking back, his lapis pomander against his nose.
"You are not using the front peristyle."
"We know,"
said Death.
"You are using the back way."
"Yes."
"Yes."
The peristyle looked exactly the same as it had the last time he'd seen it. Four colonnades of celadon columns that stood in the middle of nothing. It was a pale, pointless reflection of architecture that sheltered no one and led nowhere. Not that there was anything to be sheltered from. There wasn't a sky, just an above of celadon. There wasn't a ground, just a below of celadon. It all blended together at the horizon, a dizzying prospect, with no discernible top or bottom or beginning or end. The custodians like it that way. No top or bottom or then or now. No differences meant no decisions. No decisions meant no mistakes. Death took a deep breath and started walking. The back way was a vast emptiness leading to whispering mangles where the real work was done. Death had read a phrase some time recently, within the last century, surely, about how no one wanted to see laws or sausages being made. Death didn't really want to see how rags were purified either. The hazy forms of cherubim stood on either side of the mangles, feeding handfuls of struggling dark souls into enormous celadon rollers that sucked them in and, by some process that even the chief administrator seemed unable to explain clearly, squeezed out the wanting and striving and trying that tormented them after their bodily captivity, so that when they came out on the other side, they were still and bright, tumbling with other shining souls down troughs until they merged into the Mare Tranquillitatis, the Sea of Tranquility, ready to be released back down. An unwitting soldier in the custodies struggled to bring back the stillness and grace of the great peace before. Death wasn't much for the Mare Tranquillitatis, but then he hadn't much cared for the great peace before, either. And he really didn't like the way the souls that he so carefully collected struggled against the mangles.
"The ragpicker are here,"
echoed a jittery cherub, holding his elaborately chased and pierced pomander of rose quartz to his stubby nose.
"The ragpicker is here,"
Death said sharply.
"I am here."
"Ragpicker and I is here?"
amended the blur, uncertainly. All of the cherubim held their pomanders to their noses as they watched Death walk past. One who had been feeding a rag into a mangle dropped his pomander and chased after it, leaving Nazreem Asif to wiggle silently between the giant rollers like a garter snake on a glue trap. Death hurried past, his eyes fastened on the celadon under his Vans, until he reached the celadon door into the celadon room with confines hinted at by a slightly raised threshold, but no walls. A celadon desk stood in the middle with the quite solid Abdiel. The custodian's chief administrator rarely left his desk, which meant that Abdiel then was at his desk, and Abdiel now was at his desk, so he coalesced into a comparatively firm shape, even if the outlines were shaky. A celadon urn filled with scrolls stood on the left corner of Abdiel's desk. He kept a purified soul, opalescent and immobile, in the bottom of a long, shallow dish on the right, so that he would always be reminded of what the custodes were working toward. Abdiel said nothing for a long time, just continued writing.
So,
Death took a deep breath.
We made a mistake?
Abdiel did not look up from his work.
Do we remember Admonishments 14?
Abdiel finally asked. That was the other thing Death disliked about being up. Someone always asking him about admonishments, and he'd rather let his studies lapse.
Portet lavare manus?
No, not employees must wash hands. Think, ragpicker.
Fragiris to Amiris?
What in these circumstances would lead you to think of you break it, you buy it?
Abdiel exhaled wearily. Then he took a deep breath and intoned,
Negligentia in obedientia, idem est.
Because Abdiel was known throughout the heavens for his intoning.
And why is carelessness the same as disobedience?
Death thought back to his four failed attempts at righteousness. He squinched up his eyes and thought, concentrating hard. But as hard as he concentrated, he'd forgotten why a mistake was the same as disobedience.
Because obedience is not simply doing a task. It is being devoted enough to that task that you ignore anything that might mislead you.
Abdiel snapped.
You made a mistake and were thus disobedient.
Abdiel's silver stylus flowed silently across the length of Celadon papyrus.
We hear you breathing, ragpicker. Hop to it. Or do you not have enough to do?
Because she wasn't dying, Molly Malloy wasn't on his list. As far as the celestial accountants were concerned, she had died in Mount Sinai, and her file closed. Unable to track her down through any of the normal means, Death returned to room 801, where Frank Spivak now lay. A nurse, frozen in the moment of changing the dressing around Frank's port, leaned her bottom against the chair where the girl had eaten atomic wings only a few hours before. Frank had picked at his lunch tray, but hadn't touched the nutritionally balanced pudding, for institutional use only, so Death rummaged in the big outer pocket where he kept his personal supplies and found his spork. By the time he had reached the nurse's station, he had finished Frank's nutritionally balanced pudding and threw the plastic cup in the trash, carefully licking off his spork before dropping it back in his pocket. At the nurse's station, a wire-thin woman in purple scrubs sat in front of a laptop. Death checked the frozen screen over her shoulder and got a whiff of her tropical melon body spray, which smelled nothing like the tropics or melons or bodies, and made his nose itch. Pulling on his rubber gloves, he moved the wire-thin woman's elbow and searched through the paper files until he found Mary Malloy. Mary's ills were legion. High blood pressure, COPD, osteoarthritis, atherosclerosis. The list ran on and on. Craning his head, he found Mary's Manhattan Valley address, which was also the address of her granddaughter, Molly, who was listed as her contact. He made a few stops, first to pick up the souls of a handful of miners in Queensland, then running through the remains of a train wreck in the Belarus. In between, he dipped in and out of the rent-stabilized studio on 109th Street, waiting for his schedule to coincide with that of the woman who was dead, but just didn't know it yet. Molly Malloy was in the tiny bathroom, leaning over the sink and spitting out pink cinnamon-scented foam when he finally found her. He waited patiently for her to stand up so he could get a clear shot at her omphalos. He had just started to slide his rubber-clad index finger and thumb under the waist of her pajama pants when her fist caught his jaw. Which wasn't the worst part. The worst part was that, as the bathroom was so small, he stumbled against the tub and lost his balance and grabbed at the shower curtain, which pulled free from its rings with a pop, 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 pop. He fell into the tub while the torn vinyl sheet of blue and green daisies floated over him.
Ow.
He said, feeling the squashed spot at the back of his head, and when he looked up, the young woman was looming over him, menacing him with a toilet plunger.
"What are you doing here?" she asked, her voice as cold.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?